Promotion Man, the true backstories of the most iconic bands in the world, told by Fred Myers and interviewed by me, L.A. Lloyd. Get involved and interact on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You'll find the links at promotion-man.com. That's promotion-man.com. Download the weekly Promotion Man podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or your favorite podcast provider.
All right, today we have Paul Fishkin with us, and this is our second opportunity to interview Paul. So thank you, Paul, for calling in today.
Sure, my pleasure.
And today we're going to focus entirely on Stevie Nicks, right, Lloyd?
Yeah, Stevie Nicks. I mean, we needed the whole show. We needed the whole time spent from Paul and Stevie.
Yeah, well, that's a show, right?
Well, and that's why we're here. Yeah. So, of course, so that I have like notes prepared, I went into Wikipedia, and I had to jump in the shower, so I pushed print. Not realizing on Stevie Nicks it was 32 pages long. I come out of the shower, it's still printing. I'm like, what is, how many copies did I print? But I'm looking at some words here I want to read out loud because it's kind of cool. It says, Nicks wrote and recorded demos for a solo project during the Tusk sessions in 1979 and the Tusk World Tour of 1979-80. Nicks, Danny Goldberg, and Paul Fishkin founded Modern Records to record and release Nicks' material.
That's correct.
Well,
how many lawyers did you have to hire to make that happen?
Well, a lot. Well, we had one really good one.
Yeah.
And a couple turkeys. one guy who was the head of the law firm, David Braun, may he rest in peace. Well, nice guy, but anyway, he was so nervous about this deal because we were asking a lot of money, and we wanted to shop it to all the labels first, and who would we could get maybe the most money from, and then we have a secondary choice, which was Doug Morris in Atlantic, because he was my buddy at the time. But anyway, it was crazy. Yeah, so he didn't believe in it. The one lawyer, the head lawyer, that anyway, he just said but still, I'll be there if you need me. So we had a meeting with Elektra, and we said, all right, Dave, we're meeting with Elektra tomorrow at 2. Can you be there? He said, absolutely. And so we go to the office, and then we get together. He said, I'll meet you there. So we go to meet Joe Smith and Elektra at the time, and Dave never showed up. So however, Jeff Ingber, who was the guy who worked for David, who's the second in command, did a great job for us.
Nice.
Anyway, that's what it was. But my thing about lawyers is, you know, the best way to have lawyers and deal with lawyers is to, A, make sure you remind them they work for you, you don't work for them. And secondly, is that, you know, to try to make the deals yourself and let them clean it up, but not let them dictate the rules. So.
Nice.
Amen.
Yeah, it makes total sense. Well, listen, on all these Facebook pages out there that are very classic rock generated, there's a photo that's just amazing to me. It's George Harrison with Stevie Nicks, and they have these little earth cups, kind of like a small one you'd use to pot a plant. And I guess it had mezcal in it. And I guess the photo was generated from a Warner Brother meetings in Acapulco. And weren't you in the picture with those two?
Yes, I was about a foot away from the picture.
And Simo, you're cut out because you're not George Harrison or Stevie Nicks.
But that time I met her, it was at that convention in 76 or 7. I actually don't remember the year. I think it was 76. It was a big Warner Brother. They had it every year. And for a couple times, they had it at the Acapulco Princess in Acapulco. And the whole company was down there. It was amazing. And I was head of Bearsville at the time. I was president of Bearsville Records. And so that's why I was there. Because Warner was distributing us. And so the opening night party, you know, was this wild, this is the record business, man, 76. That was, everybody had those things around their neck, and the guys were walking around pouring, you know.
Mezcal.
Mezcal. Cups which, and everybody.
Which you could trip on if you drink enough.
Yeah.
It was, who knows, yes. Well, we did. but anyway, it was wild and woolly, no holds barred. So, but somehow, either Mo or Rosa, somebody introduced me to Stevie. They were in George. George was sitting at the same table with Stevie right by the pool. And George was there because he was introducing his new record label that was being distributed by Warner Brothers.
Dark Horse?
So he was there. Yeah, Dark Horse. Stevie was there because she had just left the record plant in Sausalito with the Rumors album in her pocket.
Jeez.
On a cassette. And so she came down to the convention to, you know, to deliver the album.
What, and I don't want to interrupt you, but I'm going to, only because David Kahn, do you remember David Kahn at Warner Brothers in Buffalo in that section of the country? Okay, so we interviewed David, and he has a podcast with us as well. And he had told us how Stevie was asking different Warner people if they'd want to come up to her room to hear this new album. Right?
Yeah.
I mean, how crazy is that? It ends up being the biggest selling album ever.
I'll tell you what happens real quick.
Okay.
So anyway, I was introduced to them, of course, being honored to meet George Harrison was enough for me.
Golly.
Anyway, so believe it or not, Dave Urso is calling me on the phone right now, but I'm not going to take the call. I see his name popped up on my phone.
Tell that Spiener. Tell that Spiener I miss him.
Right. He might have been the one who introduced me to Stevie. It might have been him, Mo, or Thyrette. I forget. Anyway, I sit down with them, meet her, and of course I'd known about her. I wasn't a fan yet. I just didn't, you know, I knew about Rhiannon and I knew that it was a huge album. And, but I, you know, I just was a little detached from the Fleetwood Mac situation at that point because I was running Bears. Well, anyway, so we met, was instant camaraderie. George was wonderful and she was amazing. And I fell in love in 20 seconds, you know, just sitting talking to her. And I told her I was Bears World Records. Albert Grossman was my partner. And she went crazy because her idol was Janis Joplin, and he managed Janis. So instant, yeah. I mean, it was really amazing. I couldn't have thought it was better.
Couldn't have scripted it better, huh?
Yeah, exactly. So, and we were getting loaded. So, yes, that's what she did. She invited at a certain point. Oh, but in between, they wanted to throw her in the pool. Because everybody got drunk, all the promotion guys, and they were plotting to throw everybody in the pool, and they started throwing people in the pool, the executives, and I could see their eyes pointing to our table, and they were, you know, you could see what was going on, and she turns to me, somebody comes up to us and says, they want to throw you guys in the pool, so she turns to me, now I've met her now about 10 minutes, turns to me, grabs my arm and says, no matter what, do not let them throw me in the pool, I'm terrified of water. So once again, here we go, unscripted, perfect. I get up, walk around to the pool side, tell everybody, if you throw this girl in the pool, I promise you, you'll be, you know,
party's over,
you know, right? And I saw Mo and I said, tell them right now, do not do this, she's terrified of it. And he, you know, so it was taken care of.
I
get back to the table, took care of it, they ain't throwing you in the pool. She looked at me and said, thank you. And then we all got loaded, and she said, you want to come up to my room and listen to everybody, me and George, and, you know, whoever else she asked. It's true. She invited her room to listen to the Rumors album. We went up there. It was insane.
Like on cassette, right? It was on a cassette.
Yes. Meanwhile, she passes out, and whoever else is in the room is listening to this unbelievable record. We're all jumping around on the bed. I mean, it was a suite. It was crazy.
Unbelievable. So hold on, because we got to really dig down on this. So George Harrison was in the room?
Yeah.
And do you remember David Kahn? Do you remember, like, who do you remember seeing explicitly, you know, jumping around?
Me, Stevie, and George. I haven't the slightest idea who else was there.
Because you're all on mezcal.
Honestly.
Okay. Fair enough. Yeah.
But like I said, she passed out, and we listened to it. It was just a delight. Obviously, we knew this was such a big album, and one listener, you know, it was unbelievable. So it was a genuine response, even however loaded we were, to this amazing record that turns out to be the biggest record in history until Michael Jackson's Thriller, you know.
Right.
And, you know, whatever. So that's how that happened.
Wow. Well... you know, when I was at Warner Brothers, there was this guy named Kim Anderson, and I didn't really, I met him one time, and I remember vaguely him being a pretty big guy dark hair, easygoing, like a super easy kind of guy.
Yes.
And in some of the literature that
I... originally the Minneapolis local guy.
Oh, is that right?
Initially, yeah.
Yeah, so in the Wikipedia information I brought up, so I had some more talking points, there was this thing that I read that just, you know, hurt my heart. And it basically, Nix's first solo album, Belladonna, was released July 27th of 81 to critical and commercial acclaim. And it reached Billboard number one on the Billboard 200 chart. But but this is what Stevie had said that really kind of hurts my heart. She said, the day that Belladonna reached number one on the Billboard 200, Nix was told that her best friend, Robin Anderson, had leukemia. Yeah. Anderson was pregnant at the time and given only 3 months to live, and she gave birth to a son, appointing Nix as the child's grandmother. Godmother. And she said, I never got to enjoy Belladonna at all because my friend was dying.
Wow.
Something went out that day and something left. And following Robin's death in 82, Nix married Robin's widower, Kim Anderson, believing that Robin would want her to care for the baby. And she said, we were all in such insane grief, just completely deranged, you know, and they divorced like 3 months later.
Yeah.
So I just thought that just definitely hurt my heart because, you know, here she's got her own first number one solo album.
Yep.
And she finds out the same day that her best friend is going to pass.
Yeah, it was horrible.
And this segment brought to you by Fred Debbie Downer.
Yeah, well.
That is sad, though, man.
Yeah, no, and Robin, her name was Robin Snyder before she married Kim, and she was her best friend from high school, you know, and she was a wonderful girl, Robin, a big supporter of ours. And we tried to make the deal with Stevie for the solo career. And she went to work for Danny for a while as a publicist for Danny's publicity company, PR company, which he had before we started Modern. And then he had it after we made the deal with Modern for a while until, you know, anyway, so yeah, that was a tragedy.
So, and Stevie was a partner with you and Danny on the label Modern Records.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes. She actually, at the end, we wanted to make her a partner. That was part of my thinking. That would be a smart way to make this deal.
Right.
And the deal was an impossible deal to make. We made the most impossible deal, you know, one of the top five impossible deals in the history of the music business, you know. Her voice is driving the biggest album in the world, and we were able to sign her for a solo career.
So I've always wondered what the rest of the band members in Fleetwood Mac thought about it. I mean, were they supportive, or they were like, this Paul Fishkin guy's a piece of crap, you know, stay the hell away from him, or what?
Well, the latter. They hated it.
Oh, okay.
Desperately against it. We had to fight everybody. It was an impossible thing to do, but we did it. I must say, I'm really proud of it. They hated it. Mick, we went to Mick. We tried to go before the fact to tell him we were going to do this, and we tried to tell him it would be one on one is three. In those days, when an artist went solo out of a group, generally the group broke up. I mean, they were, you know, that's the 70s, and that's generally where the thinking was that's what would happen. And in fact, it did happen a number of times.
Yeah.
In Stevie's situation, to me, and I learned from her, it was the opposite. If she stayed and couldn't make solo records, she would be unhappy and eventually leave. So we went to Mick and told him that. I said, she's got, you know, an album full of hits that she can't get on the record because the story's been told many times. They can only have three songs each on the record, collectively with the band. And she had this extra, you know, all these extra songs, and she needed to express herself as a solo artist. And I said, we'd protect her. And bottom line, Mick, you get priority first in everything she does. The band gets priority, and that's what I was thinking was that would convince him that was okay. And I said, then if she has a hit, it's only going to be better for the band, not worse. Besides, if she doesn't do it, she's going to leave anyway because she's bitter about the fact that she can only have three songs in the record, plus Silver Springs was left off the Rumors album, and that she was furious about that. And so that's what I learned. And by the way, she played me the demo, quote-unquote, of her solo stuff. She played me in Acapulco. So that was before Tusk. It was after Rumors had been finished when she was in Acapulco. But she had these songs collected over a bunch of couple, 3 years. And that's when I couldn't believe my ears. She played me this cassette. We were on the beach. And I said, well, this cassette is a hit album in to itself.
Right.
Just so you understand. she said, well, what am I going to do? And that's when I said, well, maybe you can... we can make a record someday, you know.
Wow.
That'd be great.
That is so, that was so crazy. Well, had you ever seen that documentary called Defiant Ones with Dr. Dre and
Jimmy
Iovine?
Yeah. Paul's in that. Paul's actually in that.
Oh, okay. So the reason I'm going there is because Jimmy had really was the one that grabbed that track of Tom Petty's.
That's right.
And so can you kind of tell us your point of view of how that whole played out of Stop Dragging Your Heart?
Yes, absolutely. He did tell the story in the Defiant Ones. He told his version of it, which was, you know, from his point of view. The truth is, we made Belladonna, and we knew we really didn't have that first single. And mainly what we knew was that the guys who programmed the rock stations in that era loved her. Except they didn't know that they would play her as a solo artist because she had, despite her love for Janis Joplin, she had the reputation based on Rihanna and all that sort of stuff she did on stage as a little more airy-fairy and not exactly a rock chick. Everybody loves Stevie and they couldn't wait to hear this record, but they, at the same time they said, but I don't know if I can play it. So we did our research, man. So we knew...
Sounds like it.
So obviously then what we needed was a rocker to start as the first single to establish our image as the, you know, and then Jimmy was doing Petty at the time. Mm-hmm. And, we'd meet every day to discuss, Jimmy and I, to discuss, the plans for Belladonna and all that stuff while he was doing, the Petty album. So we decided we needed a hit, and one of the thoughts was let's get a guy to do a duet with her, you know, a rock guy, and that would, you know, help the image and all that stuff. And then Petty had Stop Dragging My Heart Around. That was an outtake at that point. He had rejected it for his album, and Jimmy said, we got this song, and I think this could be the one that we're talking about. I got to talk to Tom to do a duet with her, which he did. There was another song called The Insider, and so initially... Tom agreed to do it with The Insider, which was a ballad being on Stevie's album, and Stop Dragging with Stevie's voice on it being on Tom's album. And Jimmy wisely and very expertly got Tom to switch it around and convinced him that he would be better off to have Stop Dragging on Stevie's album and The Insider on Tom's album, which, you know, is sort of legendary story about, you know, later on Tom was bitter about it, but then Jimmy said, but look how much money you made. And then Tom said, yeah, you're right. And, you know, Tom fell in love with Stevie anyway, and her, you know, just who she was and all about her. So it took months to convince Tom, and Jimmy did it very,
diplomatically. Yeah.
Yes. And we literally talk every day about how the best way to go about convincing Tom to do this. We consulted, he consulted me every day, I'm proud to say, about the strategy to do it. And then one night we had dinner with Tom and I met him. We even talked about Tom maybe coming on to Modern through MCA. It's a long story.
Wow.
But, at a certain point, MCA was interested in making a deal for Modern Records.
Right.
And Tom was on MCA through Denny Cordell's label, and he wanted to get off that, but he couldn't get off MCA. So at one point, I proposed, incredibly enough, having Tom go through Modern and Stevie on the new deal that we would make with MCA, and they actually agreed to do it. And I met with Elliot Roberts, who was his manager at the time, and everybody was excited about doing this. And then they fired the guy who we were negotiating with at MCA, Bob Steiner, his name was. And so that deal fell through, which was just as well because MCA was not a great label in those days.
I want to ask you an urban legend I've heard, and it kind of relates to Tom Petty also. And this is in regards to Edge of 17. And I had read, and I've never heard Stevie say these words, but she said she kind of got the idea of the title of that song when she met Tom's wife, who had a very Southern thick accent, and something about they had met at the age of 17. But she said, we met at the age of 17, and it kind of sounded like edge instead of age. And I was just curious if that's an urban legend or if that's actually true.
Absolutely true.
Wow. All right.
Because Jane did have that, you know, Tallahassee accent, Gainesville accent.
Yeah. And what a great song. What a great edgy track to follow up. Yeah. Stop perfect. Dragon.
It was the perfect, yes, exactly, Edge was. But anyway, so, because we had Edge recorded, but we didn't see it as the first single. So we did have sort of an edgy rocker kind of thing on the album. It's not like we had all ballads and all sort of, you know, spaced out songs. We had some great stuff. Plus, we had the Henley duet.
Yeah.
Which was, by the way, on the original demo that she played me in Acapulco.
Wow.
Here's Don Henley singing Leather and Lace with her, and she turns to me and said, what do you think? I said, it's number one record.
Oh my gosh.
I said, you don't even have to re-record it. It's done.
Leather and Lace, another classic.
Yeah.
So, you know, so that's true about Jane. And Stevie, yes, has told that story, and it's absolutely true. I remember when it happened. I mean, I remember the story literally in the beginning when she did the song and when she recorded it and told that story then, and, you know, that's why she wanted to call it the Edge of 17 instead of the Age of. So anyway, it was exactly correct and true and great story and great song.
Can we talk about the album cover? Because, I mean, it's very cool. I mean, she's sitting there holding the dove. She's got that look on her face. I mean, it's primo Stevie. So how many shots did you have before you guys decided on the actual one?
We had a million of them, but
a million.
But Herbie Worthington, who was her photographer, main photographer in those days, he had shot the Rumors album. I think he had shot the cover for the Rumors and the Rihanna album, you know, the Fleetwood Mac album, the untitled one that had Rihanna on it, the one prior to Rumors.
Right.
So he was already sort of a legendary photographer. He was a crazy guy, but a sweetheart. And he'd shot a lot of Jimi Hendrix stuff. And anyway, so, we had a lot of shots, and that was just, you know, that's the one we chose. It sort of encompassed everything in terms of her image that we wanted to project, you know, in terms of how she looked and the look and then the bird and all that stuff. It was just perfect. So we just picked it and we were right.
So I love to ask this question to a lot of the people that we've have on this show. So you had Stop Dragging My Heart, then Edge of 17, but let me ask you a question about Stand Back.
Leather and Lace was the second single.
Okay, so Leather and Lace.
Yeah.
So,
and then Edge, yeah.
So when you first heard the track Stand Back, you know, probably on a demo, do you remember like where you were and what your instant thought was when you heard that track? Because that one's got a punch to it for sure.
Yeah, well, now that was Stand Back was on the Wild Heart, the second album.
Second album.
Just to, you know, be clear. The singles on the Belladonna album were Stop Dragging My Heart Around, Leather and Lace, and then Edge of 17. And then actually we released
After the Glitter
Phase. After the Glitter Phase, that's the fourth single.
Yep.
You know, a couple in the second year after the album had already.
And I don't think that song ever got its. It's due, to be honest. I think it's a great song.
Me too. I love that song. I thought it would be the fourth hit. But it was a little, I don't know, it just didn't catch in the way we had expected to, nor as how the others had caught in terms of radio. I guess it was just a little too different, sort of, in terms of, you know, the first three singles. And I don't know. I always thought it would be a huge hit, but it was like a mid-chart. But at that point, the album was already huge, and we were. Most people thought that we shouldn't even release a fourth single at that point, and you know, they were kind of right, but it didn't matter.
Did you ever meet Don Henley after this was put on the album? I mean, obviously, it's some performances and stuff, but I mean, did you have any kind of behind the scenes conversations with him about being on that song?
Oh yeah, when I was there when he recorded his. We did re-record.
Okay, gotcha.
The demo could have been the track. But we re-recorded it, and he did his lead, and I was there for that whole session. And then when he comped it, he's, you know, Henley's a mad comper. You know, he had 13 tracks, I believe, at the time of his vocal. I think he had as many as 13 that he was comping, you know, which is meaning each line he would pick the best vocal out of the 13 he'd recorded. Maybe 13 is an exaggeration, but not much of one. He had a lot of tracks. They were all great to me and perfect, but, you know, he was a nut about perfection. He a perfectionist, obviously. And so he would spend like a whole day sitting at the desk, you know, in the studio, A-ing each vocal, going over each line and picking the right line. And, you know, most people might think that that means it's not spontaneous or cool, but in his case, it didn't matter. All the vocals were extremely soulful and beautiful.
Yeah, he's got such a rich voice.
And every album recorded today is like that anyway.
Is that right?
Pretty much, yeah. It's all track by track.
To a large degree, yeah. Well, that's true, to a large degree. But
yeah, I guess so.
He was a nut about that. And anyway, you know, people love to talk about the one take wonder. Well, you know, that was a cool thing because the vibe was there and the soul was in it and it's spontaneous. And that's true to a certain extent. But also, if you're as good as he is and talented as he is, comping it doesn't take any of the soulfulness.
You want to get it right.
You know.
Well, and you know what?
You want to get it right.
And that brings me to the question of her doing a lot of backup vocals and duets with a lot of people. Kenny Loggins, John Stewart, obviously.
That's right.
You know, and so that was pretty cool as well, you know, especially like the Kenny Loggins.
Yeah. Well, that was sort of part of our, not strategy, but we certainly embraced between the time that we signed her and the album actually came out, which is a couple of years, you know, these opportunities came up and we were very excited about all of them and encouraged her completely to do them because at that point she would ask, so John Stewart wants me to be on it, should I do it? And Loggins has this song and I heard the song and I heard her, she did a rough demo on it and I said, yeah, definitely do it. I was always not happy the way they billed her on that record. It should have been billed as a duet, but for some reason, Loggins decided to bill himself as the singer, and then she got a credit underneath it, like as a vocalist, you know. But it was ridiculous because it was a duet. Period.
I agree.
Without her, it would have been nothing.
So well, anyway, when you got Tom Petty and Don Henley on yours, you kind of have to pay it forward and do it on somebody else's, I guess, right?
Yeah, you know, so exactly. So anyway, so those songs that she was on in the interim period from the group, you know, collective group consciousness and sort of anticipating her solo career were actually perfect moments because they individualized her and people in radio got to, you know, have more of a sense and her fans of her as an individual. I mean, because it was the group, you know, and once again, you know, Rhiannon was Fleetwood Mac. It wasn't Stevie Nicks.
Yeah.
So even though she was in the group, and in those days, it was a little harder to individualize people in the group in terms of their, you know. And so we still had to work hard at promoting her individually to people in radio, to people in the industry, to PR people, to the press, that she was unique and individual. As much as she was getting great attention for being such a unique character, it still was a little bit of a fight to make sure that that was clear in her image and that she could do rock and roll and all that stuff. We had to work actually pretty hard on that.
So once you had a few hits there, I mean, did radio start?
Well, then we had the Rolling Stone article, which, you know, was the capper of all of it.
Yeah.
Where she was on the cover and, you know, and the headline was, you know, Stevie Nicks, the and her Magic Kingdom, the reigning queen of rock and roll. So all the work that we did to put in to sort of focus the image on the rock side paid off I can't even tell you how perfectly it paid off.
So when she's getting pulled by everyone, I mean, did she make herself accessible for interviews and radio, or was she kind of like, you know, I can't handle all this. It's kind of coming pretty fast.
Well, that's a good question, and she initially didn't want to, but I told her, and so did Danny, that, look, if you're going to do this, you have to be serious about the solo thing, and now that Fleetwood obviously has agreed that you understands you're doing it, like I said, initially they freaked out, but we did it anyway, and so I said, but you have to promote your, you know, yourself as a solo artist, even though you're a member of the group, always support the group, and you can tell everybody in interviews they're the priority, anything you want, but you have to show up and do this stuff.
Yeah.
And she did, and cool. She was great. And I took her on a promotion tour, which to this day people, you know, will tell me, they thank me that I, you know, that they were able to meet her individually and for the record, and she was great, and of course she was unbelievably wonderful with all these people. And they were just very grateful for it. So,
and you had good backers, again, you know, because you were on distributed through Atlantic Records, correct?
Yes.
Yeah. So, I mean, you had a really good group of people, you know, with the Modern Association with Atlantic as part of that as well. Which
absolutely, yeah. Well, I mean, once again, we Doug Morris at the time was the head of ATCO at Atlantic. And he was an old friend of mine.
Right.
From the days when I first started out in the business.
Right.
He helped teach me the promotion business. I think I told you in the
interview. Yeah, yeah.
Anyway,
which
so
is great.
We were very close. And he had then advanced from having just Big Tree Records, which was just a singles label, really, to the go to Atlantic. Atlantic bought Big Tree, so he was part of that. And then they gave him ATCO as a label to run. They rejuvenated ATCO and brought it back because it had, you know, that had been dormant for a while. Anyway, so and he learned the business and he signed Stevie. That was one of his first signings, which helped him with credibility as being a record guy more than just a promotion guy.
Perfect.
And then he signed Pete Townsend for his solo record. So
oh, that's right.
He started to show his talent. Anyway, that's why we went to Atlantic, because of my relationship with Doug.
Excellent.
And knowing he was moving up fast in the label, and Jerry Greenberg was a huge fan of Stevie, and he was president of Atlantic at the time, and he was a big fan. And so I liked Jerry. And then Ahmet, of course, Erdogan, who is the god of the record business, legendary, and he was a big Stevie fan, too.
I loved his book, by the way. It was a great book. All right, I have another like left field question for you.
Sure.
So Stevie had a lot of romantic relationships with different people, but the one that I find probably the one that you raise your eyebrows is Joe Walsh. only because it's hard to see them two as a couple, but what I'm interested in, because Joe's really a deep, deep guy, much deeper than people are willing to give him credit for. And I wonder what influence Joe might have had on her or she might have had on him. What would, in your view, when you were watching that go on, what were you thinking?
Well, that's a hard one for me to answer, a hard one for me to, you know. They were going out when, doing the Wild Heart album, the second album.
Right.
She loved him, you know, and he had lost his daughter. It was kind of tragic.
Yeah.
He was really he was drinking a lot, which he is, you know, all this is public information, so yeah. I'm not, you know.
Yeah, yeah. No, when we had a episode about him and we understood that he had a tragic loss with his daughter in Colorado.
Yeah. So she was really loved Joe, and I met him a few times. Mostly where he was just, you know, drunk, and I didn't have much to do with it, or you know, I honestly there's things that I really can't talk about in this situation.
Yeah,
but he's an amazingly great guy, and like I said, I don't really know him well, but his life has been very. Profound in terms of what he's done with it in such a positive way. So.
Yeah, he's a great guy, and he gives a lot to charity, and he's just a good, good man. But, you know, everybody sometimes goes through dark periods, and he went through his.
Well, hey. It's funny because he's also a big Todd Rundgren fan. And,
cool.
So he's shown up a lot of the Todd shows, and, you know, so between Stevie and Todd, Joe is a big fan of the act, a big act that I was involved with. Bumped into a bunch of times, but you know. Anyway, I can't give you any more details.
No, that's. I just was issues. Curious about that because they both have such illustrious careers, and you just wonder what kind of influence one or the other might have had.
Paul, I got a question for you. So, when you get another artist, be a solo artist or whatever, and they're on another label, and I know a lot of people think about this, is like, you know, how difficult is it? I mean, I know the artists go, hey, will you be on my record? And the other artists like, absolutely. But then going to back to what we talked about at the beginning of the show, the lawyer starts, you know, stepping in. So how difficult is it to make a deal where you get another artist to be on your artist label when they're on a different one?
Good question. And, you know, when it all comes down to it, it comes down to, and that's why it comes down to relationships.
Yeah.
If you have the relationship with the artist and the trust and the desire creatively to be in a situation that they think will be productive for themselves, then they tell the lawyer what to do. You know, this has been a chronic thing in the business for years. Mm-hmm. A lot of artists will use the lawyer as an excuse for behavior of their own and blame it on the lawyer.
Right.
Not that I'm, you know. And once again, lawyers are lawyers. Everybody's an individual. There's some great lawyers and some really horrendous ones. And so mainly, however, the answer is to get power in that situation is to allow the artist that you're going after to, you know, to go after them in a creative way.
Yeah.
And support the idea that if they were with us in that situation, based on the Stevie and the other artists we have on the label and our approach towards how we did business, a small label with a lot of money, and, you know, you get attention, and we're not just, you know, kidding you about that, BSing you about that. Mm-hmm. It's the truth. That's how we do work. Everybody says they do it, but we actually do that. And all those kind of things. And at that point, any smart artist who hears that and sees that this is an opportunity to genuinely have their creativity supported, is just going to tell the lawyer they want to do the deal, and that's that. And that's how those deals happen, and that's how you overcome the power madness of the lawyers. And, you know, it's the artist's recognition that the lawyer's working for them, they're not working for the lawyer, which many artists don't get that.
Right, yeah, for sure.
You know, they get intimidated by the lawyers and by that sort of approach in the business and think that that's how they're supposed to do business.
Right.
Anyway, so, you know, it's an individualized thing, but it always comes down to one-on-one relationships and the idea that an artist can feel safe with you in terms of what they want to do and be supportive and that you're not going to rip them off and all that stuff. And that was my reputation. I had a good reputation in that area. It came natural to me, and I learned that was a smart way to do it, and I wouldn't let myself get intimidated by the cliches of the business and the lawyers and all that. So.
Well, you're a good dude, man.
You are a good dude. Well, you know. and you had a really amazing career, and it's been a pleasure to talk to you about the Fog Hat, Todd Rundgren, Bearsville, part of your life, and now with Stevie Nicks. And then we're going to come back and do a Bearsville part two because there's much more to that story. But this has been a fun episode.
Yeah.
So thank you. How would you like to end this one? Is there any special memory you've got of you and Stevie at the Grammys or something that you want to share with us?
I have a few of them. They're not necessarily special.
Yeah, I guess because the Grammys, she was nominated but never she didn't win very many.
Bottom line was Paul Cooper, may he rest in peace, who worked for Atlantic and was the one in charge of things, among other things, making sure all the Atlantic artists that would be Grammy nominated got officially, he went over the list with the Grammys as to which artists that they wanted to submit, you know, and all that stuff. And incredibly enough, Stevie was never nominated for Belladonna, which was her first and her biggest album, because Paul Cooper forgot to submit her.
Wow.
So, story that's probably never been told by anybody, you know. And he did it just by accident. I mean, it wasn't anything.
Wow.
So we never got a chance for Belladonna. And that's the year she would have won. I mean, that album was the number one record, and it was the biggest album of the year in many respects. There was a Stones album out as well and a Foreigner album, but I just have a feeling she would have won. But she certainly would have been nominated.
Yeah, absolutely.
And,
I mean, so, what part of the day do you miss that, I might probably should submit this album, and it's done okay for us? How the hell do you forget to do that? That's ridiculous.
I don't know. I guess because it was, I don't know how I did. He forgot. I mean, it was a Modern Records artist distributed by Atlantic. So maybe he was looking at the list of the, I don't know how it happened.
Yeah.
And he'll never, I mean, you know, obviously he didn't, he just blew it.
Just didn't do it.
Certainly apologetic, and everybody in the company was devastated because that would have been one of their nominees and winners probably that year. And it just happened.
Wow.
But so, yeah. And so, ironically, she never won a Grammy as a solo artist.
Okay, I have a good one. So you meet her at the convention in Acapulco at the Warner Brothers meetings. You have this amazing time with her. You listen to the Rumors album. You listen to her solo stuff where she even has Don Henley on vocals for Leather and Lace. You have a great time. And then you're on a plane back to your home. What you're sitting on the plane. What are you thinking besides being a little bit hungover?
Well, first of all, we stayed an extra week. We got together at the convention, and we became an item.
Wow.
And so it was happened very fast, like I said. And,
hey now.
Exactly. And it was great. And, you know, and then we stayed an extra week together after everybody left, after the convention, just to sort of, you know, have fun, which we did. And, and then, of course, it was crazy because, you know, she was becoming a big star. She had Rihanna, and then we were going out together. I went home. I was kind of in a daze about it. It was kind of cool. I kicked the girl out I was living with at the time.
Yeah, I think I would, too. Sorry, honey. Stevie Nicks is in my life now. You got to get the F out.
Well, the funny thing is she gave me a robe. With her name on it, so I came home with all this stuff, and then I brought the robe home and hung it in my closet, and this girl I was living with saw it, and she just left.
There you go.
Wow, what a rock and roll story, man. What a
totally
rock and roll,
totally
rock and roll. Thanks, Paul. This has been a blast. This has been so much fun. Thank you so much. And when you call Urso back, tell that Spiener that Fred said hi.
I absolutely will. All right,
man.
Thank you, Paul.
All right, thanks, guys. Absolutely. See you.
Yeah.
Lloyd, my man.
You got it.
And Fred, thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
Promotion Man, the true backstories of the most iconic bands in the world, told by Fred Myers and interviewed by me, L.A. Lloyd. Get involved and interact on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You'll find the links at promotion-man.com. That's promotion-man.com. Download the weekly Promotion Man podcast on Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Google Play, or your favorite podcast provider. We appreciate you subscribing and spreading the word, and thanks for listening.